Car Day. And I see several jackets out there, so this is going to be a fun day to hear about all kinds of things dealing with cars. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2385. We're going to go to the second bill because we have a representative here who needs to testify and get to another committee. So, Megan, will you please read the summary?
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2385 does a number of things. It clarifies the authority that a public official can obtain a vehicle dealer certificate. It provides the lessor security interest holder is exempt from having a vehicle dealer certificate if they sell vehicles at an auction conducted by a person with a certificate. It removes the exemption from requirement to have certificate for persons who buy and sell vehicles or parts for hobby or historical purposes. And removes the requirement that vehicle dealer give specific disclosure notice with vehicles sold on consignment. Thank you.
We have about seven people to testify. However, we're going to go first to Representative Greenlick, who has another appointment. So, Representative Greenlick. Sure. Good morning.
Hi, good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm here today on behalf of and with the constituent, Doug Hendrickson, who also will make a very brief statement. And I'm very pleased to be here, and I appreciate you taking me out of order so I can go back upstairs and work on the Transportation Committee, where I'm supposed to be at this time. The particular issue we're interested in, as are, I think, a great many folks here, is what appears to be a snag by deleting item 11, page 2, line 13 through 15, which seems to ensnare hobbyists who are operating in their own personal account, usually with one or two cars only, into this issue. I've spoken with Mr. King, who will be speaking for himself as well, and it is clear his intent was not to do this. So we're just here to urge you to rethink that particular amendment and arrange the bill so that the issue can be taken care of without causing undue problems for the thousands of hobbyists in the state. And if I can ask Mr. Hendrickson to make his statement, that will make my point. Thank you.
Madam Chair, thank you for letting me testify before your committee. My name is Doug Hendrickson, and I'm here to object to the wording in House Bill 2385 that would make it a crime to have a hobby or historic vehicle without being an automobile dealer. The wording, a person who collects, purchases, acquires, trades, or disposes of vehicles and vehicle parts for the person's own use in order to preserve, restore, and maintain vehicles for the person's own use for hobby or historical purposes would be removed from current law. This would effectively shut down my hobby. I own a 1936 Plymouth coupe that I'm trying to bring back to life after sitting nearly 30 years in a shed in Oregon City. If this law is passed as worded, I can't even sell my hobby to another person or even throw it away without becoming a dealer. I'm not a dealer in old or historic cars. It's just my hobby, and I enjoy it. I don't know what Monty King was thinking when he requested this bill to be sponsored, but in my opinion, it is completely destructive to my hobby and lifestyle. As I read this, I couldn't even change windshield wipers or throw the old ones away without becoming an automotive dealer. Would I be a windshield wiper dealer for one pair of wipers? This sounds unreasonable and is. And I urge you to retain the wording that maintains hobby and historical automobiles for personal use without becoming an automotive dealer.
So, does the 1936 coupe run yet?
Well, yes, it runs, and I drove it around all summer after I purchased it from Oregon City this summer. And then as the weather started to get a little rainy and bad, I brought it in my garage, and I've started doing body work, and I'm going to fix the engine, and, you know, it's just a hobby, and keeps me at home, my wife says.
We do appreciate that hobby, and we know there are many people here that are going to testify as well on that.
Thank you very much.
Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm going to have Monty King come forward now, who is the sponsor of the bill, to explain the bill to us.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Monty King. I'm Executive Director of the Oregon Independent Auto Dealers Association. First, I'd like to apologize. Somehow there was a glitch in the little procedures, and this really wasn't requested by myself. There was like five or six bills that all of a sudden came out with my name on them. They are actually requested by the Oregon Independent Auto Dealers Association Board of Directors. And if we do any amendments, I'd really appreciate my name be taken off those so that we really have the truth. Madam Chairman, members of the committee, perhaps I should go right to the hobbyist exemption. We are not against hobbyists. Our members are hobbyists. There is a glitch in the law, though, that allows anybody who says, I'm a hobbyist, to buy and sell as many vehicles of any kind that they would like. There are no licensing requirements in the state of Oregon for mechanics, for auto body people, those types of people. I understand what the gentleman who was talking before was saying, but just like anybody else, you can change wipers, you can buy parts, you can put parts on, you can take parts from, you pull at lots and put them on your cars. You can do all of those things under, well, there isn't any licensing requirements on any kind of automotive repair in the state of Oregon. There are no licensing there. The only thing we're talking about here really is, should a person who buys and sells vehicles for profit be licensed as a motor vehicle dealer? Under sub 2 of that section of the exemptions, so section 1, sub 2, if the person owns the vehicle primarily for personal, family, or household purposes, they are exempt. However many vehicles they buy, from 1 to 1,000, as long as they buy or sell the vehicles, they are totally exempt if they're titled in their name. So really, perhaps what we have here is a problem of titling the hobbyist vehicles, and that's the problem. Last year, we came upon a Pennsylvania dealer called us because he had a vehicle he'd bought from an Oregon hobbyist or a dealer, he thought, and it was sent. The title was sent to him, and it was an open title, and they were not on the title. In Pennsylvania, you can't buy a vehicle unless you're buying it from the vehicle who is on the title or in a chain of bills of sale. This person did not have a bill of sale, did not have the proper documentation. They were completely blank as far as their ownership record. And we talked about that. I called the people down in Southern Oregon. The Pennsylvania dealer also faxed me 19 pages of documents that were on the internet, and I can get those for you if you'd like those. They had sold 24 cars. They had 32 cars for sale. They were taking consignments from all over the western states. None of them were titled in their name. And when I called the lady and said, you know, I think you're a dealer. Perhaps you should have a dealer license. She said, no, I'm a hobbyist. The DMV came by here and asked me about it. And I said, I'm a hobbyist. And they went away. Not one vehicle was titled in their name. What we have here is people who are hiding behind the hobbyist exemption.
Representative Merkland has a question, right?
Yes, thank you very much, Monty. And Section 1, Subsection 2, the language doesn't directly comment on a hobbyist, and it sounds to me from your testimony like you'd be comfortable clarifying that one can buy and sell up to 5 vehicles, including for the purposes of a hobby. Am I correct?
Madam Chairman, Representative Merkley, that is absolutely correct. We will work with the hobbyists and other interested parties, Representative Greenlick, whoever it takes, to try and clarify this issue. Is not only a problem, we think, for consumers who are buying this stuff. You know, there are people hiding behind this. There's no doubt there. The state is also losing income. on titling issues. We will work with them, work over the next few weeks, bring you back, and maybe perhaps work with the chairman on getting an amendment that everybody can agree with to try and take care of the problem.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay. Next we have Jack Kinney and Dick LaRoe. OCBA. Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning. Madam Chairman and representatives, my name is Jack Kinney. I'm the Vice President of Oregon Council Vehicles. I'm a member of the Benny Car Club, which was formed in this town in 1951. We have charter members with original vehicles that they built in the 50s. So we've been here quite some time in Salem, Oregon. We initially opposed this amendment change, and I feel we were kind of, Mr. King or whoever brought this bill forward was a little short-sighted, not talking to the automotive hobbyist organizations before they brought this bill to the legislature. Looks like we could have worked out the wording between us and this thing would have been fair for everybody. Now we have, obviously we have, people have testified and they're up in arms about it. It isn't clear where this thing will go if you take the amendment out. I've suggested adding the word historical in this section 1-2 in the line of where it says primarily for personal, family, and household purposes and historical purposes. That would solve some of it. However, the word hobbyist needs to be defined probably by the state to say who is or who isn't a hobbyist. Obviously, there's car dealers that are playing the game. You're taking a car in on consignment. An automotive hobbyist doesn't do that. We're not into the car sales business. Some of us may spend 2 or 3 years or longer building a car. We don't just build 5 or 6 or 20 cars in a year. And we're building the cars. We're getting parts from swap meets or buying an old car and fixing it up. We're doing it for our own personal use and not to just sell for profit. Granted, there's profit to be made, but if you take 10 years of labor to build a car from scratch that was a $300 car and now it's a $30,000 car, you still got 10 years of labor in this thing and untold numbers of parts. So taking this exclusion out the way it's written now, I think would be probably the wrong thing to do. I think we need to go back, sit back and revise this amendment. That's all I have to say, Madam Chair.
Can I ask you, Jack, how many cars in a year would you typically sell? Would you be under that 5-car limit typically?
I haven't sold a car in I don't know how long. I have one for sale right now, a 1926 T Model T Roadster pickup, just like it was pulled out of a barn, unrestored. Other than that, I don't even have any cars for sale.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Madam Chairman and representatives, my name is Dick LaRoe. I'm the president of the Oregon Council of Vehicle Associations. I agree with what Jack just said. I would add that I personally don't want to see these people hiding behind the designation of automotive hobbyists when they aren't automotive hobbyists, so I would be willing to work with the used car dealers on getting that one rewritten. And that's about all I got to say. Does anybody have any questions?
Questions for this one?
Here.
Representative Pitts.
Would you not agree that my father is currently restoring a 63
Chevy Impala Super Sport.
Bless his heart.
Yeah. And I've got to tell you, I think my mom would come here and disagree with you as to the fact that the money and the time that you guys put into these cars, there's really not a lot of profit when all is said and done. I mean, I guarantee my mom would agree with that. But, I mean, when I talk about the cost of restoration, I mean, it's not a cheap thing. So maybe you could elaborate a little bit on, if you were to buy, for example, this car for $300, pull it out of a barn, total rust bucket, what is it going to cost for you to, in fact, restore it to the degree to where it's worth $30,000?
Well, initially, Representative Kitts, initially the running gear on an old car has to be changed into a more modern system, and that costs just about, depending, $3,000 to $4,000 per axle.
Sure.
You could spend $5,000 or $6,000 if you wanted to have everything chrome plated and what have you. And that's installed on the frame. That gives you a modern running gear on a chassis, brakes and all that sort of thing. That's just the frame. This is called frame off restoration. You have the body off the frame. You have restored the frame, reinforced anything that needed to be reinforced, change the engine motor mounts to put a modern engine in it. Just the wiring harness to make this new engine in an old chassis work, $500-$600, some more, depending on how far you go. Paint jobs on those kind of cars, up to $5,000.
Yeah.
So you can add up those numbers real quick, and we're not just building these cars overnight to sell for profit. That just doesn't work. And I understand where your mother's coming from. I have a wife that's beating me up now and then.
Follow
up. Fortunately, they have a good marriage. I think they had a bad marriage. She might be a little bit better. She'd be more inclined. That being said, I think I just want to make the case to the committee that it's not like it's a lucrative business for you guys when all is said and done. So
that's true. In fact, there's one member here in the area who has owned a 32 Ford 5-window coupe for 49 years, and you'll be able to see it in the Roadster show this year for the first time. It's rolling and running. That's a long time. And he's a current member and past president of the Ben 8 Car Club.
No. I would agree, 49 years is a long time.
That's a long time, but he didn't throw it away. He kept the car, and when he got to where he could, he started restoring it.
Representative Shoffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just so I get this clear, it doesn't sound like you gentlemen or Mr. Hendrickson is against going after the individual Mr. King was talking about who had 24 cars sold or sale. It doesn't sound like you're opposed to, and these folks that are using your title as hobbyist or historical restorer of cars, which is great. I enjoy going to car shows too. It doesn't sound like you're opposed to making those folks quit doing that kind of illegitimate business. It's just that you want to continue with what you're doing without any kind of hassles or added regulation onto your hobby. Am I correct in what I'm hearing?
I believe you're right on the money there. Yeah, very correct. I think the bottom line is that we could sit down with these folks and rewrite this amendment and make it work for everybody and make it do what he wants to do. And obviously we as taxpayers of Oregon would like to see that as well. We don't like to see any illegal operations. And that can be a problem. This internet sales is just absolutely wide open. To hide behind us as a hobbyist, I think, is terribly wrong. But until we have this amendment written correctly, then we'll all suffer for it.
Thank you.
I'm sure I have a question.
Representative Kitts.
Maybe it's not of, I think it's probably more of Monty, if I could address it to Monty, even though he's on the table.
Okay, let's release this group. Thank you for your testimony, and I appreciate your ideas about adding the definition.
Okay.
Thank you. And call Monty King back.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Monty King, Oregon Independent Auto Dealers Association.
Representative Kitts.
Thanks for coming back, Monty. How would this amendment work, or how would this bill work if, let's just say, for example, I went out and I found good deals on cars, and I wanted to just turn them, you know, one or two a month and make, you know, $500 to $1,000 per car per month for some extra cash. Would I then have to be classified as a dealer, regardless if it was a hobby car or an older car?
Madam Chairman, Representative Kitts, right now, when DMV came by your place after perhaps a consumer complaint, all you'd have to say is, I'm a hobbyist.
Even if I were selling a 2000 Ford F-250 diesel?
There's nothing there. There is no definition, as far as we can see, about what you're selling or how you're selling it or how you're displaying it, where you're located, where you're parking the cars, how you do signage, how you do advertising, unfair trade practices, DEQ, seatbelts, safety. I can keep going. There is absolutely nothing. As far as we can tell, the hobbyist exemption is so undefined as to be basically meaningless for any kind of consumer or business protection.
Okay, I understand the parameters that we're dealing with. Let's say that this was in place and I couldn't say hobbyist. Let's say I didn't want to say hobbyist. Let's say I simply went out there and I looked in the newspaper and I found what I deemed to be a good deal, and I turned around and sold this car and made $500. Would I have to have a dealer's permit?
Madam Chairman, Representative Kitts, if you titled the vehicle in your own name and you drove that for your own personal or household use for a month, you would not have to be a dealer. Or whatever period of time. Under sub 2, after you have done this 5 times within a year, then you could be asked to prove that you're not a dealer. This wording was put in back in, we think, the late 70s or early 80s by then Representative Yee. We don't really know, nobody really knows or has really gone into it too much to understand where the 5 rule come in. The 5 rule is probably the most misunderstood rule in the state of Oregon as far as dealers. If you're buying and selling to make a profit, you're a dealer at 1. If you are buying and selling for your own personal household or whatever, the other word,
that
if
way.
You're doing that, you have an unlimited exemption for as many as you want to buy and sell. Just if it's at 6 or above, they can ask you to prove you're not a dealer. If you're not titling them at all, I think there's a presumption in there that you are a dealer. Rarely does a hobbyist not title, but sometimes they don't. Onesies and twosies, there's no problem.
So as long as I'm buying a car, titling it my name, drive it for a month, I can turn around and sell as many as I want.
Madam Chairman, Representative Kitts, as long as you say it's my personal and household use to the DMV guy when he comes by, that is correct, sir.
Okay. I just need a clarification.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Monty.
Let's go on to our next group of witnesses. I'm going to call 3 up at a time in the interest of time. So Lyle Stevenson from Linn County, Larry Leck or Beck, and Gail Meyer. Good morning. Thank you for coming.
Good morning. My name is Lyle Stevenson, and I live in Linn County, and I'm a hobbyist. And most of a fair share of what I intended to say has been covered a little bit, so I won't be redundant. I would say that the committee should take note of 822.070 has to do with construction of vehicles and selling them. So that's also something to consider in conjunction with, I think it was Section 2, subsection, which did he mention, where you could sell 5 vehicles
That would be section one, subsection two.
Right. I think I'm going to be speaking for a huge portion of the hobbyists that are involved in what we're discussing today. And first of all, I'm a veteran, a Vietnam veteran, and a huge portion of us are vets in either Korean War or Vietnam War. And I'm also a retired police officer. And I'm at a point in my life when I can now do these kinds of things. And this is the one thing that I enjoy. Of course, as it's been said, removing this wording is going to have not just a devastating effect, but it will end our interest. I and most of us, I think, would say that we don't disagree with the wording that's there, as has been said. So disagreeing with the wording is not something that we do. The wording is fine. It should not be removed, is what we submit. And regard to Representative Kitt's questions about money, we all have to smile, because these hobbies really are nothing more than a money pit. For true. And there probably isn't a hobbyist alive that's ever made a penny on a hobby, as far as cars are concerned. Usually when we acquire a car and anticipate rebuilding and restoring it, we don't consider how much we might make on it. What we consider is how close we can come to breaking even. Usually you don't. I guess what I'm submitting is that we are not in competition with the Oregon Dealers Association in any way, shape, or form. We don't want to do what they do. We don't go to them for what we need. In fact, they don't have what we need and never will have. Many times we acquire an old relic or a piece out of a barn that we have simply salvaged, and ordinarily many times don't even keep it for ourselves. Maybe we'll salvage it and just pass it on to another one of our enthusiasts because he needs the parts or whatever, and get no money for it whatsoever.
Mr. Stevenson, let me ask you, as a former police officer, though, people that are taking advantage of this loophole and maybe providing cars to people that might be in the country illegally on consignment, do you see a problem there, and how do we narrow that down?
I'm not sure that I can say that exactly, but I do think that deleting this entire portion as it is not the answer. That's what I can say. I think it's a matter of a reality. A person is either a dealer or they're not. Simple as that. Now, how you as a committee would go about defining that, that might be a little bit of something to give consideration. It might be something to work on, but changing the wording to this or removing it is no solution in my judgment, and I think I speak for most everyone here.
Let's go to Larry. I guess Larry is next on the list.
Yeah, I'm Larry Leak, and I'm president of Western Antique Power. We're a museum north of Salem here, and the thing in here that really just concerns me is that we put on swap meets as well as other groups in the state of Oregon, and as far as vehicles goes, that includes tractors and other things that they keep in here. There's no definition in this bill, and so we have the swap meet, and indeed we're not a dealer in parts ourselves, but we have these vendors that come to our swap meet, and that's one of our sources of revenue for operation of the museum. And things like this concern me because it would not allow the hobbyists to sell parts or vehicles there without, you know, somebody coming along. Say if somebody really wanted to enforce the way this is written, they could come out and write everybody out there a citation for that's swapping parts. And that would certainly put an end to the hobby and put an end to any possibility of operating a museum, because that's where a lot of the parts are exchanged and things. And this is really a concern. I'm also into old cars, and I have been since I was 12 years old. I bought my first car, and I still have it. So it's kind of one of the things that it concerns me, the way this is written. It needs to be redone and define what is a dealer in some sort of manner that's acceptable to the hobbyist. Thank you.
And Gary. Or excuse me, Gail Meyer.
It's Gail. Good morning, and thank you for the opportunity to talk to you, Madam Chairman and representatives. Really appreciate that. My name is Gail Meyer. I've had a boring address for about 50 years, and I'm associated with a car club out in Sandy, Oregon called Route 26 Cruisers. And we have around 200 members, and we've been a car club only since 96, so we're a fairly new club. I'm a hobbyist, but also I work as a retirement job for a company called Westcott's Auto Restyling, and they're located in the community of Damascus on Highway 212. 4D Westcott, very, very nice gentleman. So to answer maybe or shed a little more light onto Representative Kitt's discussion about a $30,000 car, that car may cost that person $50,000 to build that $30,000 car. Working for the company that I do, I've got pretty good first-hand knowledge of what it takes. I have several cars. Our car club has kind of a neat idea of we do a thing called Cruise Oregon. This is the third year we've done it. We will have around 200 cars going, taking a tour of the state of Oregon. We take a week in the middle of July. Now, these people are all hobbyists, and we trade, buy, and sell parts. Do our own stuff. I have a shop at home. I work on my cars. I look at my cars as my hunting, fishing, drinking, chewing, smoking, and chasing wild women money. And so I do. I spend quite a lot of money on my automobiles. I don't keep a running record of it because I don't really want to know. Out in front of the building here, you'll see I drove a 1956 Cadillac. I've had the car about 2.5 years. It is totally an original car. Came from downtown Salem here someplace. It's pink. And everybody laughs. But I'll tell you what. We have 4 children and 7 grandchildren. And the youngest grandchild just turned 3. And he knows Papa's pink Cadillac. And so we're preserving something for another generation. And we are the original recyclers. That's what we do. And it just, if there's one bad apple in the box, why are we all going to suffer for it? I don't know. Any questions?
Well, Mr. Meyer, I want to make clear we certainly don't want to unduly hamper the hobbyists, because I have 3 boys, and a lot goes on in our garage just mechanically on old cars, and it's an education tool as well. So we value that, and it's important to the state of Oregon. Representative Schaffler.
I'm going to ask you the same question as the last two gentlemen.
Yes.
Do you see any, are you opposed? There's no one here advocating for allowing people to sell as many cars as they want without a license to deal in automobiles in Oregon. None of you three are opposed to making it so that those kinds of folks can be gone after according to the law.
No.
The folks that are pretending to be hobbyists but really aren't, and who can be harmed, I think they're selling to folks that don't have enough money, they don't have a license, they don't have an insurance. You can be driving down the road in your pink Cadillac, and some idiot out there without a license or insurance, mm-hmm. can buy one of these cars with good plates on it and crash into your beautiful car, which you'll never be able to replace. And God knows you can't replace your grandchildren. Yeah. So that's who can be harmed. But none of you three are opposed to creating language that will go after these folks that aren't here advocating in their behalf today. Am I correct in assuming that?
I would agree, yeah.
As long as it was not part of
right.
this.
Right. Believe me, I don't think anyone in here wants to go after you guys. We love what you're doing. So,
Madam Chairperson, can I add one other item?
Sure.
One other thing, where I live is exclusive farm use, and even if it weren't, many of us live in small, you know, neighborhood communities, and even if we were so inclined and had the money, we would not be able to get a dealer's license.
Because of the zoning.
Because of the zoning.
Okay. Thank you so much. Well, thank you. We appreciate your testimony, and Representative Kitts is looking for a 65 Mustang convertible should anybody see it.
I'll meet you right outside the door.
I can't afford one.
You don't know what they pay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Call Paul Cosgrove.
Don't take a
chance. United Financial Lobby and Alliance of Auto Manufacturers. He is not here. Kelly Taylor. She's heading for the door. Okay. Welcome, ODOT.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kelly Tater, Department of Transportation, and I just wanted to touch base with you on a couple of things, and I won't take up any more of your time because I know you've heard a lot about this. We just wanted to let you know that if we suddenly had to even try to license a small portion of everybody out there in this world, in this state, that is maybe a hobbyist, a historian, trading, selling parts or anything, it would be a huge, huge impact to us to try to even do a small number of them. We currently have, there's currently about 2,600 licensed dealers in the state. And in talking with one of the gentlemen in the car clubs, I said, you know, if you had to estimate how many just car club members there are across the state, what would you say? And he goes, oh, gosh, you know, 20,000 or so, you know. So even if 10% of them suddenly found themselves in the area of needing to be a dealer, I mean, that would like double practically our workload. So it would be substantial. So I won't touch on that any more than you've already heard. I just wanted to say that there's another section of the bill that people haven't talked about yet. I've talked a little bit to Department of Justice, and that's in Section 2 of the bill, the part that's repealing the consignment notice that's given, disclosure that's given to people that buy a car that happens to be on consignment. That was put in, it's my understanding, we're trying to do a history a little bit, a couple of sessions ago, to actually give consumer protection. If you're buying a car from a dealer and they're selling on a consignment, they're not required to clear up the liens on that. So what this is telling you as a buyer is you need to go make sure that anything that's been on this car is cleared up, otherwise you get to inherit it. So I just wanted to bring that up, that I think that that's an important disclosure statement. And so I would be a little concerned about some consumer protection if that were repealed. And that was about it. I just want to let you know it's got a big fiscal. We haven't quite got our arms around it because it's hard to figure out how many people out there are trading and swapping parts and fixing cars and all that, but we think it would be a pretty sizable hit to us.
Kelly, is there a way, in your opinion, that we could further define hobbyists to prohibit people that would be selling 24, 36 cars in a year?
Well, Madam Chair, frankly, I think that if somebody were doing that, I know that you guys have talked about the one car versus five car thing, and yet it does say if you've got five, it really what happens is if you are out there selling multiple cars, we can look into it. And the burden of proof is what shifts at five cars from us trying to make the case to you trying to show that you're not a dealer. And so if there were somebody out there and we knew of it and we could look at the paperwork, then we would probably say that they are a vehicle dealer, unless they absolutely were putting all of those titles into their name and could prove that they were their personal use. I know Representative Kitts mentioned about, you know, gee, if I buy and sell a car every month. Again, after five cars, the burden of proof falls on him to show us that it really was personal or family use.
I'm not a dealer.
Excuse me, that's Section 11, though.
Right.
Where they say they're a hobbyist and there's no
right.
definition, what does ODOT do then?
That becomes more difficult because people don't have to show us paperwork. And so what I would like to do is explore that, like you're saying, Madam Chair, and look at that. Maybe there's some paperwork that has to be maintained and made available to the department so that we can tell that you were truly doing it for hobby. That exemption is fairly broad. It's been there for years and years and years, and it talks about trading vehicle parts, not just vehicles, collecting, trading, maintaining. I asked the Attorney General's office, I said, does maintaining to me is sort of like tune-up, you know, like backyard mechanics, and I know there's lots of them. It would hit them too. So this, I'm not sure how we get there other than maybe some paperwork requirements and our ability to be able to say to you, you have to show me your paperwork to show me that this truly was for your own use and that you weren't, you know, who did you sell it to? And if it looks like they're being sold, you know, like way out of the area or out of state or something, maybe that would be the clue we go, aha, you know, it isn't just your own. But, again, there are people who sell cars on eBay that's their own use, and they put them out on eBay. So it gets tough to get your arms around it, but I'd be happy to try to come up with something with you.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You bet.
Questions for Kelly? Thank you.
Thank you.
And I want to make clear, we don't want to increase the paperwork burden on the hobbyists either, so we will work on this. Paul Cosgrove has returned.
Madam Chairwoman, Paul Cosgrove representing the Oregon Financial Services Association. I apologize, I'm covering a hearing next door, and that's where I was. I'm here on behalf of the United Financial Lobby, which is the banks, credit unions, savings and loans to the extent we still have them in Oregon, and the consumer finance companies that are members of the Oregon Financial Services Association. I'm also appearing on behalf of the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers, which, as you know, auto manufacturers have a number of subsidiaries, Ford Motor Credit Corporation, General Motors Acceptance Corp, that do a lot of car financing. Our specific concern has to do with the additional language being proposed to be added in Section 1 of the bill on lines 22 and 23. Current law allows a lessor, one of our lenders, lessor, or security interest holder, one of our financial institutions, not to sell a vehicle that they have repossessed without having a dealer certificate. Now, most of those sales do go through auctions, which is what the bold-faced language proposed to be added addresses. But currently, the Uniform Commercial Code applicable in Oregon and all other states requires those lessors and financial institutions to sell the vehicles that they repossess in the manner most reasonable under the circumstances to recover the most value to apply to the loan and reduce the deficiency owed by the consumer. And in many cases, that's appropriate then for those financial institutions not to use an auto auction house, but to do what's called under the Uniform Commercial Code a private sale. You'll see this particularly in smaller towns where a branch of a credit union has repossessed a car, and they make the determination that, in fact, by putting that car for sale on their lot, and advertising it as car for sale, they're able to yield more recovery and therefore reduce the deficiency or even produce a surplus for the consumer than by incurring the cost of shipping it to an auto auction house in Portland. So we would oppose the addition of those additional requirements. This would actually cut off one of the two options that we have under the Uniform Commercial Code and I think be anti-consumer as well as anti-financial institution. We don't have any other position on any of the other aspects of the bill, but wanted to highlight that those two lines, line 22, excuse me, and 23. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Rosenbaum. Thank you, Madam Chair. Paul, I know my credit union advertises in its newsletter cars that have been repossessed that are for sale to credit, I assume anybody, but to credit union members that newsletter goes. Is that one of the practices you're talking about that wouldn't be allowed then under this language?
Okay, Representative Rosenbaum, that is under the Uniform Commercial Code a private sale, one of the ones that would be prohibited under this amendment. That credit union could not do that any longer. They would have to send it to an auto auction house. And frankly, auto auction houses can sometimes get a good value, but they often are a wholesale value. The kind of practice you're mentioning is quite common, and the reason it's used is it sometimes gives a better value for the car. You're correct. It would be banned.
Okay. Questions for Paul further?
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you, Paul. I appreciate you pointing that out. Last we have Eugene Ebersole, who is with the Attorney General's Office, Department of Justice. Fraud Section.
Hi. Good morning, Madam Chair. Eugene Ebersole, Financial Fraud Section, Oregon Department of Justice. We kind of got taken by surprise on this bill. We weren't quite ready to come today, but when we heard some other bills and I saw this, we did feel the need to make a few comments. I have worked with Department of Administrative Services on numerous occasions, and I'm reasonably certain that under subsection 313, they would be opposed to that additional language. It's not real clear that it requires DAS to go out and get a dealer certificate, but it says they can, and having worked with DAS, and I know the independent auto dealers have had numerous discussions with them regarding the sale of their cars at auction, and the old police cars, old state cars, confiscated cars, and they have a multi-tiered layer of protections that are already in place that I think are more than ample to address the consumer protection issues on those types of sales, and to require the state of Oregon to become a dealer, or DAS to become a dealer, I think would be one burden that would just be unnecessary, and in this days of cost effectiveness and budget cutting, it would be one more cost added to the pie than one more set of layers of bureaucracy that we really don't need. Secondly, in agreement with the DMV, but for different purposes, we are opposed to subsection 2, the disclosure, removal of the disclosure of consignment vehicles. I've spoken with Monty King on this, and we're not per se against making it better. It's just we haven't had a chance to look at this, and to just carte blanche delete it would take some protection for consumers out by having them know prior to buying a car who the previous lien holders were. There's, of course, no way of making a consumer that was led to the information do the right thing, go out and make sure that their purchase is protected, but at least there is that protection should an intelligent consumer want to use it. With Mr. King, we could work with him and come up with maybe some better language or a better disclosure that would couple this information going to DMV, having it being reported quickly, more quickly. It's a 10-day window now, make it a 5-day window. There are alternatives. I would just say, in its present form, to just automatically agree to eliminate it is premature at this time. And I think also we'd be glad to work with the historical dealers in trying to help you folks come up with some language. I think that's not that difficult a problem. We have other bills. I think one that Monty drafted is before you today on the Unlawful Trade Practice Act, because curbstoners are a major problem in this state. And they are a scourge on the citizens of this state. The people that are here today, that are hobbyists, that I've seen represented today, are not of that group. And I think with their help, we can come up with some language, historical rebuilders or something that very clearly identifies who the good guys are as opposed to the bad guys. Because we do need to stop the administrative process that DMV has used to stop curbstoners by finding them has been reasonably ineffective, because they're always out on the street. So we have some good ideas you'll see later in the session that will help us put an end to that type of illegal business, and those bills will have no impact on these fine people.
Good. Could you tell me, Mr. Ebersole, could you just give us a definition of curbstoner? What typically do they do?
Basically, they have it amazes me. It's a person who is able to act as an auto dealer without having any of the licensing, bonding, disclosure requirements that are required of valid dealers. I'm not sure how they procure their cars in every instance. I know in some instances they probably get them in an auction somehow. Don't ask me how, because I don't know how. But they are able to accumulate a large stock of motor vehicles. Recently, I've seen some administrative fines come from DMV, where there was a dealer who was able to go to Coparts Auto Auction, which is the junker auto auction. That's the one that really scared me. Coparts is up in Vancouver. They get all the cars from the insurance companies that are totaled for one reason or another, whether they were stolen or wrecked. And these people are able to go there, buy the cars, glue them back together so they look nice, go park them out on the curb, out on the street with a little sticker so it looks like it's Joe Consumer selling the car, and in fact sell the motor vehicle without disclosing its problems, without letting people know that they should have the rights that a dealer is selling them, no recourse and no ability to go after a bond if something were to go wrong with the car. There's quite a few. I mean, it's rampant throughout the state. I know since Monty King took over as the Independent Auto Dealers Association, he's been very good at trying to isolate and help local law enforcement stop it, but we have a few bills that'll work it real well. One is an addition to the Unlawful Trade Practice Act that Monty put forth that will make it a per se violation of the UTPA. We've been going after them under the UTPA all along, but this makes it that much cleaner. And I drafted a few amendments to the RICO bill to make selling as an unlicensed dealer a RICO predicate act. It's already a crime, but to make that crime a predicate act for RICO, which will be an enormous tool for both law enforcement, criminal law enforcement, and particularly for our civil law enforcement, where we can find these guys, find out if they have a cache of cars somewhere, and under the RICO bill go in and seize them all and confiscate them. That will get their attention.
Representative Gerard.
Mr. Eversole, perhaps you can clear something up for me, because I remember last session we passed a bill sponsored by Mr. King that stopped the curbstoners. Did we not put a strong enough penalty in that, or I was thinking that bill's already on the book for that law.
Which bill is that now?
Mr. King.
The problem with fines, Representative Gerard, Madam Chairman, the problem with fines is you have to collect them. And these people are not necessarily the kind of people that are going to take their money and put it in the bank where we can garnish it. And the DMV's got lots of fines. That's always been one of the things the legislature has looked with a jaded eye towards us in enforcement, is like, you have all these fines out there, why aren't you going out and collecting them? And we give them to revenue, and we try ourselves with our collection unit, but it's not so easy. What's easy is when you have somebody that works in a itinerant fashion that moves from place to place, that if you see the car on the street is there, and we're able to identify that car as a curbstoner's car, we can go to the court with a provisional process document, if it was under RICO, and be able to get a provisional process to go out and take that car and impound it. And if we were able to impound that vehicle, of course, in RICO, it already has a section to protect the rights of innocent parties. So if it belonged to somebody else, was a consignment car or something like that, their rights would be protected. But if you could get the ill-gotten gain away from the criminal, and these guys are criminals. They're breaking the law. It's a crime to do this. So I'm not saying Monty's bill isn't one tool in an arsenal to use, but with this type of illicit business, every tool you can put in our toolbox will help us bring an end to it.
Follow up, Madam?
Follow up.
So in other words, the bill didn't go far enough.
Yes, sir.
And Monty, you want to comment?
Representative Close, Representative Gerard, the bill is effective that we passed last session. We are seeing more people who were curbers come in and get dealers' licenses now. It definitely has increased awareness in the curber community, and there have been a few people who have been hit with $25,000, $30,000, $45,000. You'd have to ask DMV if they're actually paying them or not. Usually they just leave the state, and that's okay too. But those fines won't go away, as far as I know. But it's really hard to get blood out of a turnip. The problem has always been you catch him with 10 cars for sale, 10 cars he sold. You hit him for say $25,000 or something. He's still got the 10 cars for sale, and there's nothing anybody can do anything with those. And he's going to have to do something with them, either that or get a dealer's license, which some of them do. But that bill has been very effective. But we need to take the next two steps, which is one later today and one in transportation, one in judiciary. There are two more steps that we think we should take.
Thank you.
Okay, if you would stay with us a moment, I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2385 and open a hearing on House Bill 2429. And this is more what we're talking about. It's the adding this as an unlawful trade practice. So I would like you, Monty, to speak to that bill while you're at the podium. And Mr. Eversole, if you have time, could you also?
Yes, I do.
Thank you, hobbyists, for coming. Thank you for coming. And we're calling Representative Schaffler, Monteking.
Cleared out the
room. Representative Dalton.
We sue under this now.
The
personal violation just makes
sense. No question.
So it's a curious logic that says, which of the that holds himself out as one of these?
Yes.
This is going to be fun.
Rather than having to go through this implied.
Put the sword down.
We just had.
Welcome, Representative Schaffler. Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee. This is the first time I've ever done this, so I stumble. Forgive me. But I think it's fair that I do get out here and do this if I presume to sit up there in judgment. This is about Mike Schaffler, 12910 Southeast Ridgecrest Road, Happy Valley, Oregon. As we've been talking, a lot of the things I'm going to cover here have already been covered, but these folks that are out there, these unlicensed dealers, these curbers, they're not very good people. And we're not talking about folks that are selling their own cars or these nice folks behind us that were here or hobbyists. We're talking about people that are out there preying on the poor and on those that and providing vehicles for those that don't have license or insurance for whatever reason. These illegitimate business folks don't pay taxes on their income. They don't want to be responsible for the vehicles they're selling. They don't want to be on any ownership records. They have been suspended, or many of them have been suspended or revoked from having a dealer's license. They don't want to pay their fair share of industry regulatory costs, which makes me think that we have the industry here putting more regulations on themselves and trying to protect not just the consumer but the industry itself, which I think is a good thing. And that's one of the things I'm pleasantly surprised at in Salem. There's so much of this going on where industry is actually coming to work with government. And you don't read about that in the paper. All you hear about is the incessant bickering that the press likes to talk about. That's a little editorializing here. Forgive me. They don't want to compete on an even playing field with other dealers. These folks don't want to advertise fairly with proper disclosures to their customers on branded titles and wrecked cars. They don't want to comply with environmental rules on air, water, and land pollution controls. Are buying cars from other illegal dealers in a conspiracy to commit fraud on consumers. Most of these reasons are, quote, unfair trade practices, unquote. It has come to our attention. They cannot be charged with a business fraud in court with the unfair trade practices because they are not licensed dealers. The current situation seems unfair to the thousands of honest dealers who are trying to comply with the host of regulations from local, city, and state federal governments. Unlicensed dealers are dealers. They should be under the same rules as licensed dealers. When they do get caught, we should let the people who have been hurt by their unlicensed business actions go after them for their damages. That is what this bill will do. It should also be noted that these illegal dealers are operating on property that is not zoned commercially. That's already been talked about today. Park these cars on other businesses' property, for example, parking lots, or on public property, right on the street corner. By operating in this fashion, they are circumventing the planning processes that local communities use to decide where businesses can and cannot operate in their neighborhood. They also avoid paying commercial property taxes. The great thing about this bill is there does not need to be more government inspectors or investigators for it to be effective. We can let the customers go after them once they realize they have been defrauded. And, you know, I think we're already being pretty loose by even allowing folks to sell five cars. I cannot so much go out and put a nail in someone's house without a contractor's license and insurance and bond. The federal government or the state government does not allow me to go out and do five projects without a license, without insurance and bond. My wife can't go out and drill on five people's teeth without being a licensed dentist. And there's no reason why these folks should be let off the hook on this. I urge we pass this out of committee, and I thank you for your time.
Representative Stoffler, could I just ask you, well, I guess we'll let the panel speak, and then we'll go to questions. Representative Dalton, would you like to come forward since this is your bill as well?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Billy Dalto, Oregon State Representative, House District 21. I want to talk a little bit about this bill this morning. Every day, consumers in our state are being defrauded by individuals illegally acting as automobile dealers. Because they're not registered as an automobile dealer, these individuals are exploiting a loophole that essentially prevents them from being charged with committing an unfair trade practices violation. Not only does this loophole put thousands of consumers at risk, it creates an uneven playing field for what I consider to be law-abiding auto dealers. I know this to be the case because once upon a time I used to be a car salesperson, so I have personal experience here. And although I only sold, although I sold mostly new cars, I did sell quite a few used cars. And my experience with selling used cars is that the dealerships generally do a good job of taking in cars and inspecting them and creating or enacting any repairs that are needed for safety reasons and to trying to recondition the car as best as practical for safety reasons. And curbside dealers do not do this. Curbside dealers don't generally do this. Curbside auto dealers purposely don't seek to be licensed because they generally prefer to operate outside of regulation. Curbside auto dealers tend to operate on a cash basis so as to avoid the reporting of sales for income tax purposes or any other purposes. They generally are not in compliance with disclosure requirements or environmental regulations, and nor are they paying their fair share with respect to the industry regulatory costs. So what you might see is a curbside auto dealer selling a vehicle to a consumer without disclosing that there's some sort of brand or clout on the title. And that might be that the title had been wrecked, that the car had been wrecked or flooded or some sort of damage that has to be disclosed on the title itself. And so, you know, the consumer one day may find out that their car has been wrecked or has some sort of problem and really doesn't have any recourse against this dealer under the Unfair Trade Practices Act get some sort of, satisfaction. If the consumer can find the curbside auto dealer, they soon will realize that they can't bring litigation against the dealer. House Bill 2429 is essentially a housekeeping bill that will bring curbside auto dealers under the regulation of Oregon's Unfair Trade Practices Act. It's a solid piece of pro-consumer legislation, and I respectfully request that the committee pass this bill out this morning. Thank you, and open it up to any questions, but please no jokes about car salespeople.
Questions, Representative Kitts.
I was just going to comment, Representative DeVolta, before my question. I was like, if you go to law school, you hit the trifecta of lawyers, politicians, and car salesmen. So,
thank you very much. I think my mother would like me to go to law school, but I'm doing something a little different.
I will get to my question. Thank you for taking my humor so graciously. I'm reading over the statutes here, 822.015, and my question is, I'm having a hard time, and maybe you don't know the answer to the question, but somebody can help you, defining what exactly is a dealer. Is it based on the number of cars sold? Is it based on where these cars, from where these cars are sold? I'm having a hard time getting my arms around the classification of what a dealer is.
Madam Chair, Representative Kitts, I think what you want to think about is what is the reason the cars are being sold? You know, if you have a personal vehicle or vehicles that you're trying to sell because you're disposing of them for whatever reason, you do not want to maintain them any longer, that's really a personal sale. What you want to think about when you think about dealers is folks that are selling vehicles to make a living or to make a profit consistently. And so I would think that the independent auto dealers wouldn't have too much concern over folks selling maybe one car a month or something like that, or maybe even two cars a month. But even when you start to get to two cars a month, you start to sell a lot of cars in a year, 24 cars. And so, you know, that's really, you're starting to act as a dealer because of the volume. So the clarification here is for your personal sale, because you want to dispose of the cars, versus sort of a wholesale attempt to make a profit at selling cars. And so the line is a little bit gray there, but what this piece of legislation is trying to do is sort of force those folks who are trying to make a profit through the sale of cars to register themselves so that consumers have the protection. You know, if you wanted to go and sell your truck, you know, you can do that. It's your individual, you know, vehicle. And you're not acting as a dealer, but if you wanted to sell, you know, a few, and you purchase cars to, for the sale, for the purpose of reselling them, that's acting as a dealer, and that's what we're trying to work with here.
Follow.
Got to tell you, that was the most elaborate answer that I still don't understand, Representative Dalto. So you're saying that the independent auto dealers would be fine with selling up to 12 cars a year, which would be one a month, or but not as many as two, which would be 24. And I'm not trying to be difficult, but I'm trying to, if we're going to make it an offense of acting, of a dealer acting, I want to know the definition. You know, I need to know what a definition is of that dealer. And let me give you an example. My truck. You've seen my truck. I got a good deal on my truck. I could sell my truck now for more money than I paid for it. And I could, 6 months from now, I could probably do the same thing. So if I were to sell that truck, buy another car, I'm making money, drive that car for a few months, sell it, you know, so that I'm essentially driving for free, which I'm not opposed to. And I don't think anybody in this room is. But my question is, and I'm trying to get my arms around, if we implement this, who does it apply to?
Madam Chair, Representative Kitts, for the example that you described, you would not be acting as a dealer if you sell one or two cars a year.
Okay.
That is not what I would consider anyway, having been a salesperson, what I would consider a dealer. Now, you might wish to pose the same question for the independent auto dealers in terms of what number
sure.
of cars. But I would say if you're selling a handful of cars in a year's time, you're not a dealer. You know, but if you've got a lot, if you've got a collection of cars somewhere, and there, you know, a couple of cars, and you're selling one or two cars a month on a consistent basis, you are acting as a dealer.
Okay. So could we define it as someone that does this as a sole means to make a living? You know, that is their income, that is their job, is to sell cars?
Madam Chair, Representative Kitts, I do not think that is an acceptable definition, because your curbers, as they're called, will have other employment. It just happens that they have, you know, 10 cars in their driveway that they're buying and selling. I mean, it doesn't have anything to do with income, sole income. It just, you know, if you are purchasing cars with the intent of selling them, reselling them to others, you know, you're acting as a dealer.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much, and we'll let Mr. Ebersole comment on that.
Madam Chair, Representative Kitts, it's really not that complex in your question. The Unlawful Trade Practice Act solely applies in its consumer side to personal household type transactions, personal use. I think that we would agree with Monty King and the independent auto dealers that zero cars should be sold for profit if you're in the business of selling cars. Now, does that mean that the hobbyist is not exempt? No. Like you, when you buy your car, I think this was stated before, you're going to register it in your name.
Sure.
None of these curbers are registering these cars in their names.
Madam Chair.
Follow.
So is that the problem?
I think
from what I'm understanding.
You have to, you know, one of the problems with drafting really tight legislation is that somebody's going to find a loophole. So we want to be a little bit broad, and it's a factual determination. You know, you always can give somebody an out to prove that they're not. But, you know, it's a per se violation. A per se violation doesn't mean somebody is automatically guilty. It just means the burden of proof is now shifted to them, prove that they're not a dealer.
Follow up. So Monty, from the question that I asked earlier, as long as the person is titling that car in their name and personal use applies, regardless of how long, a person can sell that car and not have to worry about being deemed a dealer or pursue a dealer's license. Am I understanding that correctly?
Madam Chairman, Representative Kitts, you are.
Okay, and you don't care how many cars that person sells as long as they're titling them in their name, driving them for some length of time for personal use. Am I understanding that correctly?
Representative Kitts, Madam Chair, yes. The thing about that is, give me an example. I have a friend who's had old cars and collector's cars, Corvettes. He likes his cars, and he has a few bucks in his pocket. He's got an 8-car garage. If something happened to him financially, and his stock went down, and all of a sudden he's out of a job, and he has to liquidate all 10 cars in a week, he can liquidate all 10 cars in a week, and he's still not a dealer because those are his cars. He's had them all that time. He's babied them. He's driven them on and off. And, you know, a nice day he drives the MG, and a rainy day he drives something when it's a coupe. But if they're all his cars.
Mr. Ellisall, could I ask you, you've already got in 822.005, you've got a Class A misdemeanor on it. So by adding this under unlawful trade practices, how does this further equip you?
Under that section, that's for police powers, for the law enforcement that have badges and guns.
Okay.
We don't have any ability to utilize that right now, which is why this bill is so effective. Right now, to be honest, this bill will have no fiscal impact on the Department of Justice because we already feel that we have the power under the UTPA. I was telling Representative Merkley before when the session was closed for a second that what we do right now is kind of circuitous in that we make our logic in enforcing UTPA against the curber right now is that the only people that can hold themselves out to be dealers are licensed dealers. Therefore, if you hold yourself out to be a licensed dealer, out to be a dealer, you are implying that you have all the valid certification bonds and licenses. Therefore, under subsection 608, I think it's C, we utilize that one where causes likelihood of confusion or misunderstanding as to affiliation, connection, or association with a certification by another. So we will, at the present time, we use subsection C or subsection B on an implied holding out as a licensed dealer. Because if you hold yourself out, you must. We do the same thing with construction contractors, with landscape contractors, with auto rebuilders. Which brings me to another point, which is I've discussed with Representative Merkley, and you know, I think we would like to see this the enabling clause expanded a little bit on this bill because it does such a good job and it's such a good idea to have a per se violation for unlicensed dealers. We would like it to mirror the RICO bill that we've put up, which has unlicensed dealers, unlicensed rebuilders, unlicensed landscape contractors, and unlicensed construction contractors. Because we use that same circuitous logic to use the bill. If we had a per se violation, it would be much cleaner, number one for us, and number two for the consumer should they want to hire their own private attorney. Because under 606-608, that section of the bill is a private cause of action.
And do you have a bill number on the RICO bill?
I do.
We'd like to follow that one.
I may not have it with me, though.
Okay.
But I will get it to you before the day is out.
Do you know if it's a Senate or House bill?
It's a House bill, and it's before Judiciary.
Okay. Thank you.
What that does is it does, and as a matter of fact, I have to amend that one, too, because somehow the landscape contractor slipped out of the four prong. We only have three in there right now. So.
Madam Chair.
Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Since you've raised that point again, I would like to ask the question while the whole panel is there. A suggestion has been made of expanding this to include a violation of RS 822.070, which does seem to fit under the relating clause of uncertified vehicle dealers. I don't believe the relating clause can be amended. And so I think we would have to find a different piece of legislation in regard to the other issues you've raised, but we can check that. But is there any concerns from folks present related to including 822.070 in this unlawful trade practices?
Rebuilders.
That's RICO.
No, this is making rebuilders as well as curb cleaners. Yes.
Madam Chairman, woman Representative Merkley, I have no objections as long as it still does what it does for about the dealers. I don't represent rebuilders.
Yeah, I think the relating clause is pretty narrow on this particular bill.
The rebuilders would, Madam Chair, the rebuilders would be fitting into that same group of curbstoners that I mentioned before that would go up to Coparts Auto Auction as some sort of wrecking yard, perhaps. And some wreckers have the ability to get those parts, and they'll get those parts and rebuild the cars, and then sell them with, you know, somehow manage to get the titles cleaned up. The other big issue. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden you have this piece of junk on the street and getting sold again without a license.
Okay. Monty King?
Madam Chairman, as far as amending this bill, I'd like to see this bill continue on through the process. And if there's something later on in the session, maybe on the other side, maybe they can be joined. But I don't see any reason to hold this bill up. I think it's a perfect bill as it's written. It does what it's supposed to. It takes the next step. It's going to make business and the public safer. So the really neat thing about this is for us is it lets all the plaintiff attorneys go after these guys, and the state doesn't, and we don't have to, and the public is protected. It's kind of like having a whole bunch more DMV investigators out there. And if they are cited for unlawful dealer practices by DMV, and some attorney finds out about it, they could go after them just on that. But they're already guilty, basically. It's not going to create more of that, but it certainly is going to be something that those people are going to think about. I have them. I do classes three times a month where I do pre-licensing classes. I did one last Friday in Eugene. I had five pre-licensing and three continuing education people. One of the people in pre-licensing had been cited for unlawful dealing. And he did appreciate the class, and he did receive some money off of his fine because he was going to the class. A lot of the people in the industry used to be curbers. It's not that easy anymore. But I urge your passage of the bill as it's written.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate your bringing this bill forward. It sounds like a good addition to the tools we have now. I guess my only question would be, and maybe it's for Mr. Ebersole or Mr. King, how likely is it that there would be private lawsuits filed under this? Because it sounds like most of these transactions are probably a pretty shady nature of people who may not have the wherewithal financially or in other ways to go to a conventional dealer to buy a car. I mean, is it very likely that we're going to find a lot of lawyers willing to take on these kinds of cases for a minimal amount of damages on these cars? Or is it something where maybe the state would be able to utilize this provision to go after somebody? There's a pattern.
Representative Rosenbaum, Madam Chair, I think the bill's a very good bill. And I think that if we gave one more tool to the private attorneys, you would find that there are enough big curbstoners. There's some small ones too, but there are some fairly large ones who are repetitive offenders. I mean, we get the forms from the Oregon Dealers Association Council from DMV, their meetings every month, and the fines that they're going to levy on these guys. And it's not unusual to see one come down that has 12 cars, 13 cars. So, I mean, we're not talking about one here, one there. Some of these guys have a lot of cars. And if any of my ideas for amendments would hold this bill up, we'd be more than willing to, you know, say, hey, let the bill go forward. We don't want the bill to be held up because of something we're recommending. I just think it would be a real nice tool. When I fix tools, I like to fix them all. So they may not be practical at this particular time, but if we can't amend it at all and continue moving it forward, then I would say hold off on the amendments. And Madam Chair, that RICO bill, I found the numbers, House Bill 2104.
2104.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
And that just adds unlicensed dealers, rebuilders, construction contractors, and if amended, landscape contractors, as the crimes that go with unlicensed practice
to make those predicate offenses.
Okay. Thank you so much. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2429. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2429. Representative Rosenbaum?
You're looking for a motion?
I am.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2429 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Rosenbaum has moved House Bill 2429 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
Madam Chair.
Representative Merkley.
I've written out the line that Mr. Ebersol requested in regards to 822.070. If the Chair wants to entertain it, we could add it. And it would still be under the relating clause.
Representative Merkley, I do not believe I want to with this particular bill, but we will watch that process with the RICO bill.
Thank you very much.
Further discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Gallego?
Aye.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative
Merkley?
Aye.
Representative
Shuffler?
Aye.
Representative Kitts?
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Chair Close.
Votes aye. Motion carries. And House Bill 2429 moves to the floor. Representative Shuffler, would you like to carry this bill?
Please, thank you.
Thank you so much. Okay, we're going to close the work session on House Bill 2429. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2383, which was supposed to go first. So I apologize for those who were waiting on that bill. And we'll call Al Elkins.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Al Elkins. Excuse me, I'm representing the Oregon Tow Truck Association. I brought two real people with me today. They are to my immediate right, Mike Porter with Oregon Lien Service, and my far right, Mike Wagner with Saniam Towing and Recovering in Lyons, Oregon, and also president of the Oregon Tow Truck Association. I need, first of all, Madam Chair, to give you an overview of who we are and what we do. We tow vehicles. We work closely with law enforcement.
I'm sorry, I haven't had the summary read. I can back her just a second and have her introduce the bill before we go into the testimony.
I apologize.
That's my fault.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2383 requires persons who has a lien on a motor vehicle to remove registration plates before foreclosure sale. Requires a person who sells the motor vehicles at foreclosure sale to apply for title to the vehicle for the purchaser. Allows a person to sell five or less vehicles in a year without having vehicle dealer certificate. The vehicles are sold by the person who's foreclosing on possessory lien. Thank you.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to start by telling you a little bit of what we do. We tow vehicles. That's our living. We're not car dealers. We have come across these last few years three words that have changed our businesses altogether. Those words are forfeiture, seizure, and impoundment. We have become part of the enforcement arm with law enforcement in dealing with vehicles that are seized and impounded due to driving while suspended, driving under the influence, and driving while uninsured. We receive those vehicles on the streets and take them to our lots and go through a very tight-knit lien process and notification process of the vehicle owners through that process. The system seems to be working and working very well in terms of notification and lien, and we are actively working with our partners, and while I cannot say truthfully happy to do so with law enforcement, we do so on a very regular basis. Part of the activity that we're involved with these vehicles is to dispose of these vehicles, and I'm here today to question some of the parts of House Bill 2383 and related to that, and not support Section 3 of that bill. Section 1 of House Bill 2383 deals with plate removal, and we don't understand why a lien vehicle is any different than any other registered vehicle and why the plates need to be removed. Why would we as a lien claimant need to remove them? In our business, a lien is a legal way for the towing company to try and get compensation for service rendered. By removing the plate, it lowers the value of a vehicle at auction. One of the towers asked me, if we do remove the plates, then how is the vehicle going to get out on the street if it's without having plates, if it is sold to someone? Which is a very good question, because we can't issue any type of paper to make that work. We also have questions on Section 2, which relates to applying for titles. Most of these vehicles that we are dealing with, and I'm going to get into survey results that I have just completed here most recently with some towers, are sold or in most cases given to wrecking yards. The vehicles that we deal with in the activity of getting rid of these vehicles or disposing of these vehicles, we are doing so at a loss. And we feel by adding this Section 2, the added labor would only increase the amount of lost revenue. Section 3 has to do with vehicle dealers' licenses and would require us to have them in doing our business. We are opposed to this. We are not in the business to sell vehicles. We are in the business to tow vehicles. If the world were perfect, then every tow we do, we would get paid for. We tow for all police agencies in the state. The largest amount of vehicles that need to be liened are police tows or abandoned vehicle tows. These are tows we take a loss on, and we feel that this would burden the loss and the activity that of disposing of these vehicles. We would appreciate not having to get vehicle dealers' licenses. Our world is this. As government resources deplete, we are picking up more responsibility. We are now having to clean up at accident sites a number of spills that we didn't have to do normally or usually, because ODOT doesn't have the personnel to be there to do so, and the cities and counties don't have the personnel to be there to do so. We're not complaining about that. That's just a fact of life. We are armed with a bucket, a broom, and kitty litter or that clean sweep in order to get rid of these spills. And we are pounded on more and more by ODOT and by the police agencies to do more and more of that cleanup. In Region 4, in the Ontario La Grande area, I have spent the last 6 months working with them. They being ODOT, is going through a decrease in personnel as well. There will be less people at accident scenes. They have written a book that gives us new responsibilities. So far, I have been able to stall those responsibilities. They are asking that all towers that work in those areas on the big truck wrecks, mm-hmm. now purchase arrow boards at $3,000 to $6,000 apiece to direct traffic that ODOT would normally do. We also are responsible for hiring and maintaining flaggers at those scenes. So our costs are increasing dramatically, including our insurance costs, which have raised 50% to 80% since 9/11. In a survey that I recently did with towers in my association, I got some facts back that I found hard to believe, and I'm going through these, but I want to share them with the committee. Of those responding to my survey, 50% of all tows that they do, they're not getting paid for. It's as high as 75% in some parts of the city of Portland. But in areas south of Eugene, Albany, Corvallis, and Cottage Grove, I talked to two companies there. They are stuck with 60% to 70% of what they tow. Towers that responded to the survey are averaging 20 to 30 liens a month. And as a whole, towers, and this is what I found to be the most startling, towers are no longer being compensated for vehicles that they give to wrecking yards. They are giving the vehicles to wrecking yards for nothing. They're giving the vehicle and the lien paperwork. So they're not getting any compensation for that at all. One of the biggest expenses in dealing with these vehicles is getting rid of the garbage. I got a call from Acme Towing in Hillsboro last Tuesday, and he called me to tell me that he had just hauled in a van, a Dodge van, a 78 Dodge van. ODOT had called, and they went out and responded to the call and removed the vehicle. It was full of hazardous waste. Whoever had the van had cleaned out a building and had put asbestos and cleaning fluids and all of that stuff in it. He had had two DEQ people come out, and they told him it would cost him $600 to $800 to dispose of that material in the van. He would have to tow the van to a site and then get rid of it there. I thought maybe at times those were the exception to the rule of what we're having to deal with, but they're not. Mr. Wagner brought in this morning, he's the gentleman sitting to my far right from San Am Towing. This is a towing and recovery order, police tow, I believe it was, to pick up a 24-foot green boat. He went and picked it up, and it cost him $122 to dispose of it. He will not get paid for it, and he's got, I think, close to $200 worth of labor in it. Since he's had to tow and re-tow twice, and it was a Marion County Sheriff's tow. So we are the service providers for a lot of for all of the cities and counties of the state, and we are providing a service at no cost to the cities and counties and at a loss to us. I would like to finish my testimony, Madam Chair, by summarizing a letter sent by Ace Towing, Rod Pfeiffer, who's from Klamath Falls. He was going to be here today, but he got called, I believe, to a truck wreck early this morning, and he's still on the scene. He says he's been in the towing business for 31 years and has had to file on hundreds of unclaimed vehicles. At the present time, he is filing an average of 10 a month. He can only remember one instance in the past 31 years that he sold a vehicle for a substantial profit. However, 2 months after that he sold it, he had to refund all the money because the wheels and tires on the vehicle were stolen property. He says that the average sale price of the vehicles he sells is $75. That does not include the tow bill, much less the storage, filing expense, or the office time involved in handling the paperwork. Some vehicles we have to give away and re-tow them to the buyer for free just to get rid of them. Towing companies are not realizing a profit by selling unclaimed vehicles. Instead, it is a liability that costs us money. Requiring to have a dealer's license would only be increasing our losses. With that, I'd like to conclude my testimony, and we would be glad to answer any questions that you might have.
Representative Gerard.
Good morning.
Good morning.
If a government agency calls you and tells you there's a wreck out there, can you say no?
Yes, we can, but there are, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Representative Gerard, yes, we can say no, but there are penalties for doing that. If we say no on an abandoned vehicle, they take us off the list. If you have three no's in most contracts with the cities in the state, then you're off the contract for a very long period of time. So, you can say no, but there are penalties in doing so.
Seems to me in Klamath Falls, as an example, that the city has actually put the towing up for on a bid basis, and the lowest bid from the respective towing company got the bid. That would indicate to me that there's some kind of compensation involved.
Madam Chair, yes, Representative Gerard, there is for, I don't know what the bid number is, but it would be for all vehicles that individual tows, so he would get a reasonable fee, whatever that fee is, for all of those vehicles. Mr. Wagner probably could explain that more detail.
I'm Mike Wagner, I'm out of Lyons, Oregon. The way that it works is the bid is based upon the fact that the tower will be getting all the tows. He would assume that a certain percentage of them are going to be redeemed, and he's figured out what his losses are versus his fee and hopes that it all works out for him. In our particular company, of the police towing that we do, 50% of those vehicles are reclaimed by someone. 50% of them are left for us to dispose of. And of that 50% that we have to dispose of, about half of those are abandoned vehicles, and they bring $10 or less at the salvage yard. So I'm fortunate enough to have someone who will give me $10 sometimes. Many of my associates in this business are giving cars away for free. The wrecking yard won't pay anything for them.
Representative Gallegos.
Yeah. You mentioned that there was value in the plates. And what is the value that you place on having plates on a vehicle?
Representative Close, Madam Chair, Representative Gallegos, I believe, from what I have been told, it's in the tag. If there's a long period left on the tag and the license plate, the vehicle has more value. So if in terms of the expiration date.
So clearly, if you're having to sell an unclaimed vehicle, and you mentioned that it's forfeiture, seizure, impoundment, DUIs, questionable character of the vehicle, presumed owner, you've got plates. So, and you mentioned sometimes you're lucky to sell them for $10. Are you just selling plates as opposed to a vehicle, or?
Madam Chair, Representative Gallegos, no, we are not selling the plates. The vehicle comes with the plates.
And there's no determining where those plates. I'm sorry. Follow up. There's no determining about the owner. Are they legal plates? Does the car meet all the same requirements that any other valid driver would place upon getting their plates registered?
Madam Chairman, Representative Gallegos, my name is Mike Porter. I'm with Oregon Lien Service, and we process quite a few liens throughout the state. And to give you a little background, those plates have to match the vehicle for them to stay on the car for a lien. The process, in a quick synopsis, is vehicle's towed. The tower generally waits about 5 days because they're hoping that the public's going to come back and pay for their car. So they wait the 5 days. They either contact us or do it themselves. We contact DMV with the VIN and the plate number, make and model of the vehicle, get the legal and registered owners, notify them that your car has been towed, there are fees due, please come and pick up your car and pay for the vehicle. If they do not, in a certain amount of time, and depending on the value of the vehicle, it's usually about 30 days, it will be sold at public auction, and that's per statute. So, yes, the towers don't sell a car without a plate that matches the vehicle. But at auction, if the general public does come, and in most auctions, you're lucky if you get two or three people to show up, the plate having a value tag on it does help the value of the vehicle. So now, as opposed to paying $50, maybe they pay $75 because the tags are good on the vehicle.
Could I ask a follow-up on that? I'm told that DMV determines whether a car is insured also by the plate and the tag. So is it possible that people would buy a car not for the worth of the car but for the insurance coverage because they're an uninsured motorist?
I would suppose that it's possible that a person from the public could buy a car that does not have insurance. Near as we can tell from our surveys, the amount of the car vehicles that go to the public is about 10% of what actually goes to the lien sale process. Could be 5 to 10% of what we feel it is based upon our surveys.
Representative Kitts.
Madam Chair.
Excuse me.
Al Elkins, Oregon Tow Truck Association. On our survey, we asked the question, if you have a public auction, how many times the public attends? And 99% of the time, 100% of the people said 99% of the time no one is there but them. So then they dispose of the vehicle. So even if they have a public auction, they don't sell the vehicles at those normally. It's just no one comes. The majority of my respondents were from the rural areas, the people that I feel would be the hardest hit by this requirement.
Okay. Representative Shoffler.
Thank you. How many vehicles does the towing industry sell a year? And When you all tow or lien a vehicle, do you report to the state that specific vehicle has been picked up? And And do you report exactly who you sell the vehicle to? That's a lot of questions there. I don't mind repeating
them. Let me see if you can interrupt me if I don't get them all.
Okay.
So, the majority of the towing that we're discussing is ordered by the state. So, yes, of course, the state, county, or city does know that we've towed the vehicle because they're the ones that had us do it. That's, I would guess that's, you know, 98-99% of what we're talking about here. You asked me whether or not there's a notification that takes place. We have to, when the vehicle is sold by lien, by foreclosure of lien, the paperwork that allows a person to have ownership of that, whether they be whoever bought it, private party, wrecking yards, whomever, is turned into DMV. So certainly when that paperwork's turned in, DMV knows that the process has been completed because they are the recipient of the paperwork. There's also a form that a great many towers statewide are filling out because it's, I believe that we feel that it protects our interests. That is 6890. Thank you, Annie. And I believe that the majority of the towers in the state are, when they do their foreclosure lien, are filling that form out and sending it in. That helps clean up the whole process and notifies DMV that the car's been sold and gets into the system that way. So.
Madam Chair, how many vehicles a year are we talking about here?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Schroffer, I don't have an exact figure on those. Here's what I did. I asked the question. Hindsight is 20/20. I asked the question, how many you go to that you lean, and they said they were leaning. Hang on. They said they were leaning 20 to 30 a month. Then I asked them how many were up for auction, and they said 5 to 10 vehicles they had for an auction. I didn't ask the question, how many are you selling at the auction? So I don't have that answer. I think the average was 7 vehicles that they had up for auction a month. Now, these are the rural tours. I don't know. I haven't gotten responses back from the City of Portland tours because they haven't had enough time to complete the whole survey. So I can't even guess for you. I didn't ask the question the right way is the answer I have for you. I don't have an answer.
Okay, committee, we are running out of time. We have a bunch of people to testify, so I'm going to ask you to make quick questions, and I'm going to allow Representative Kitson to get his in, and Representative Garrard, and then we're going to go on to the next member.
Thank you.
And we'll squeeze Marianne.
In the name of time, I'm going to ask that you call my office and set up an appointment. I have several questions.
Okay, I will do that.
Thank you.
And Representative Garrard.
Mr. Elkins, it's my understanding that in some smaller communities, we suddenly have a very high number of towing companies that have suddenly sprouted up because of this ability to sell vehicles. That some towing companies are actually not in the towing business, they're in the used automobile vehicle selling business. To your knowledge, is this happening?
Madam Chair, Representative Girard, I asked that question because Monty has engraved that statement on my forehead number of times, and he's done it in a very nice way. I asked the question, and do you know of people that have TW plates that are doing just what you said? And every one of them that responded said no. I had 60 towers in a room in November at our meeting. I asked the same question multiple times because Monty was saying that over and over again, and every one of them said no. They do not know of anybody in their communities or in business that are just getting TW plates to sell vehicles. So that's the answer I have from the people I represent.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'd like to just close with one item, too.
Before you close, Gallegos had a question.
Yep, my question just has to do with what might be the typical amount of towing fee and storage fees that would be assessed at the end, and maybe the disparity between how much the car is worth and the owner just abandoning it because they can't meet that.
Are you asking, can I clarify your question?
Sure.
Are you asking how much at the end of the lien process is owed, or are you asking how much is typically owed at day 2, 3, or 4?
Well, I'd like both.
I would think that an average, and please be aware that most towing services are done on kind of a cafeteria-style pricing schedule. So if you have an accident that involved more work, like the vehicle was on its top and had to be rolled over, needed dollies, it had excessive cleanup, all of those things are charged on a per-item basis. But I would think that an average number of a tow bill on day two or three is probably in the $150 to $200 range. And I would think that by the time you hit the 30-day lien foreclosure, you're probably in the $800 to $1,100 range.
Follow up. And that $600 difference, is that storage?
Yes, it is.
Administrative
fees?
The
storage fee, yes.
Thank you. Please close, and we need to...
That concludes our testimony. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. This is fascinating, and I want the committee to know that we probably need more time on this bill, so we'll probably carry it over until Wednesday. Yeah, and I'm hoping people are able to come back. I'm going to go to Cheryl Scott now, who Monty can come back, and Eugene, I believe. But Cheryl, could you come forward? She is gone. Okay. All right. I'd like Monty King and Eugene Ebersole to come up for the final 10 minutes on this bill.
Why don't I go first? Representative Close, members of the committee, my name is Monty King, Executive Director of Oregon Independent Auto Dealers. And if I would like to first say, if we do amend this bill, I'd like my name taken off it again because it's got the wrong name on it. It should be about the request of the Oregon Independent Auto Dealers Association. First of all, I'd like to say that we would like to take out the requirement, if we do amend the bill, to take out the requirement that the person who does the lien foreclosure submit title. We'll take that out, take that off the discussion right away. This is about selling plates. This is about consumer protection. This is about people driving around on the highways without insurance, without having vehicles titled or registered in their name. This is about 52,000 cars being sold last year in this condition. And I think that's a low number. Are there cars being sold for plates? Absolutely. What's the difference? $100 to $1,200. It depends on how long the plate's good for. Why do they want those plates? So they can drive around. They don't have to go to DEQ stations. They can drive somebody else's car that's still in their name. And then you have that foreclosure papers in their hand. And if they get in an accident, they can jump out of the car, run like heck, take those papers with them, and since they were only done at the local government level, nobody's even going to know who owned the car unless you can find the right county, the right city, or the right tow guy, or the right lien company who did it. So what we have is a situation where you have all these cars. They're being sold. They know when they come into this business, they're going to sell cars. They want to sell cars, be a dealer. If they don't want to be a dealer, let's give them some kind of an exemption. We'll work with them so that they can sell those cars without having extra costs if they're going to sell them in commercially reasonable ways. Our association feels this is not a commercially reasonable way to just sell cars to whoever comes by the lot to see that car. Are they at public auction? I don't think so. Those cars are out in front of the lot with a price on them. You don't put prices on cars at auctions. There's no definition of what a public auction is. You put it in the paper, nobody knows about it. I'm going to have an auction over there. You can have 15 auctions in Salem on the same day. There's 18 tow operators and 19 tow operators here in Salem. There's 7 in Lincoln City. I don't know how many there are in Portland. There's 8, I think, in Pendleton. There are a lot of tow operators around. They are doing a great service. I think the majority of the tow companies are really doing a heck of a job for the public. In fact, I think they're being abused, if anything, by the public agencies. And they shouldn't have to be doing some of this stuff. But let's talk about where those cars are going and who they're going to and the devastation that's being brought on our citizens, our families. We're citizens too, just because we're dealers and the dealer families. There's probably 40 dealers in every state representative district in this state. We are concerned about it. We think they are selling cars. And if there's a public auction and nobody buys the car, it's our feeling that that tow company now has bought that car. And if now they have possession of the car, the public auction is over. Now they're going to sell that. They're going to bring that, have that person come by, and he's going to pay the $600 on the window, or the $1,200, or the $2,400. I've seen them $4,500. I have pictures, if you'd like to see them, of a lot within 10 blocks of here, 15 blocks. All these cars have prices on them. That's not a public auction, ladies and gentlemen.
Monty, could you pass that? I'm sorry to interrupt.
Representative Kitts has a question.
Could you pass that around so we could see that?
April McVeigh, who works for me, will pass that around.
Thank you.
These things are so confusing. We have another handout that's probably 40 pages with all the different ways you can do lien stuff. The tow happens. In fact, I'm having one of my cars towed today. It's $49 from way South Salem down to Cliffs Automotive across the street because my son let the water leak out the other day. It's $49. But by the time one of our vehicles gets towed, by the time we find out about it, we've got a tow charge, $180. We've got a local government processing fee, maybe of $50 or $100. We've got a lien fee of $75 maybe, and then we've got $25 or $30 a day of storage. Now I can park at Portland Airport for $8 a day. Why would I have to pay $30 for a gravel lot behind somebody's building? I don't know. Most people who are having these things happen to, whether they're towed, abandoned, wrecks, whatever, they're not going to come back and get these cars if it's more than about $800 or $900, unless the car has a larger value. And there's people having their cars towed and the insurance companies are paying for it and they're getting ripped off. But the great majority, I want to emphasize, the great majority of tow operators are great people doing a good business, doing it honestly. But there are problems here. The state of Oregon does not know when they get the car. When they go out and tow it, you have a local government, you have the cops called. They don't go down to DMV. There's nothing recorded at DMV that says the car has been towed. When the operator sells the vehicle at public auction, they might put in the $68.90, but nothing tells them they have to. Actually, I think the law, I'm not a lawyer, but I think the law says they're supposed to. But what if they don't? Nobody cares. Nobody's checking that. Nobody's saying you're supposed to do it. And if they don't do it, there is no repercussions for them whatsoever. Now, if my dealer doesn't put one in when he sells the same kind of vehicle to the same kind of person under the same conditions, my dealer had to put it in 165, which is a notice of vehicle purchase by a dealer, and then when they sell it and give the person the title, they have to put it in 6890. 6890, he showed you, which every single person in the state of Oregon must put in unless they transfer the title for the other person or sell it to a regular dealer. So,
Representative Gallegos.
Okay, you mentioned 6890. That, what does that form do with the DMV and the car?
Madam Chairman, Representative Gallegos, I'm sorry, I didn't say that right.
That's okay.
Gallegos. The 6890 is a notice of vehicle sale. It is required for everybody who transfers interest in a vehicle. However, there is no penalty for not doing it. In fact, there's no penalty for a dealer not doing it either, except once you have submitted that to DMV, and if that vehicle is taken out and abandoned again, then after the abandonment and after the lien and after the public sale or public auction, whatever, the tow operator can now go after that consumer or dealer or person because now their name's on the record as the last owner. So they can go after them for deficiencies on the tow. My understanding from our attorney was one tow operator in Portland had 1,500 of these deficiencies that they were going through small claims court. 93% of those are consumers on deficiencies of tow after the tow. We have another bill in the session which is going to try and put that notice from 15 days on abandonments down to 7. most states only have 2 days before the tow operator has to tell the person who owns the car they got it. In Oregon, they don't have to tell you they got your car. Actually, they don't have to write the letter until the 15th day. And on police tows or other kinds of things, they don't have to tell the person for 20 days that they to write the letter. So by the time you get the letter, you're out 18, 20, 27 days maybe at $30 a day.
Follow up. Well, and so you're saying so you'd get the letter, but that you might have sold the car already, and you're saying you get the letter on the 18th day that this car you already sold and has been abandoned. I mean, you would know if your car's missing, right? But you're saying if you filled out or didn't do a 6890, you'd be liable. I'm trying to understand. You're saying the towing company can come after me if I sell a car, don't do a 6890, that next owner abandons the car on the side of the road, now the tow operator can come after me as the only registered owner of that car for fees and deficiencies in the towing, but I wouldn't be notified until the 18th day, therefore cluing me in that I should have done that 6890 a year ago.
Madam Chairman, Representative Gallegos, that's exactly true. I don't think almost anybody in this state knows that they're supposed to submit a 6890. There's nothing on the back of the title that says in great big letters, you must submit this. I know of two people who have been around this legislature for many, many years, one of which is in the room who didn't know about it, and the other one was a former Speaker of the House from Eastern Oregon.
Who should remain nameless, right?
Well, he's still around. But it was amazing. His car was found in Seattle a year after he sold the vehicle. And my understanding is he took it to a wrecker, signed the title over, and thinking the guy's going to wreck it. And he didn't even put the wrecker's name on it. And that car, that vehicle eventually was sold to somebody who took it to Washington, drove it around with the Oregon plate on it for the next year, and then dumped it on the freeway up there, and he got the tow bill from up there. I don't know if he paid it or not, but he might not want to go to Washington for a while. Now, all states have the 6890 process. In Washington, you can go online and do it. In Oregon, you have to do the form, and most people don't do the form because there's a requirement there be a signature of the purchaser on the form, and I tell my people, send it in anyway, because this has been a huge problem. One of my little dealers in December paid out $3,500 to tow operators on vehicles because he was told by DMV staff he didn't have to put in the 6890.
Okay, I'm going to stop you, Monty, and try to give Mr. Ebersole time to comment. Committee, we're going to continue working on this bill because it's fascinating, and we have a lot more questions, I'm sure, from the committee. So we aren't going to rush this.
Kelly Taylor from DMV
is
going to
in
case we have questions about
signed up, but I'm sure you will want to comment on what's been said. So I think we'll move this over to Wednesday. And Mr. Ebersole, could you comment on the bill?
Yes, ma'am. Representative Close, members of the committee. I'm sure DMV will want to comment because we have been working on this issue quite so many months because it is contentious at best. Monty King took me on a tour the other day, which was quite enlightening, just driving down McGillcrest and seeing automobiles sitting out in the front of tow lots or behind the lots with chalk marks of prices on the cars, seeing signs posted outside the dealership that said cars for sale. I originally had formed an opinion that the lien law process really was a very well thought out method for people who have possessory liens, not just tow dealers, but car repair shops and storage facilities. It stuck with people's goods one way or the other. And I think that it probably does not necessarily have to conflict with the dealer's licensing requirements if it was used properly. That is, if you have a lien, The statutes allow you to go to the courthouse and post notice that on a certain day you're going to sell your possessory lien item at auction at a given place and time. And if you follow that procedure, I don't think that really there's an issue about any of the problems we're talking about, because that's what the legislature has set up as a means for recouping your losses on possessory liens. But I don't know that that's happening. I'm not sure that the auctions are taking place, and if they are taking place, like the tow
gentleman said before, nobody shows up. Well, the answer to get that is maybe advertise a little bit, because I know when in the state, we have sometimes we have to sell vehicles, and they're possessory liens. If you put an ad in a newspaper for a car that has some value, you will have people show up. If he lets Monty King know about the cars that are for sale at his tow auction, I guarantee you there are dealers in the state that will show up at those auctions and have a bid. I do not know whether the bids would be effective, because the tow operator, based upon the storage fee, now has such a huge lien that they could bid the full amount of their lien and still be the owners. It is at that point in time that I find there's a major problem, because when the tow operator now purchases the vehicle, exercising their lien rights and their lien judgment, they are no longer selling it as a tow operator. They're selling it as an independent business or person who owns that vehicle. And if they acquire more than 5 of these vehicles in a year under the present law, they should be required to become dealers, because there is no effective way of monitoring anything that goes on with that sale for the consumer. DMV does not have a right to send their investigators in there because they're not licensed dealers. They have no way of monitoring the process of where the cars came from, what the condition of it is. A licensed dealer, besides having to be licensed, bonded, and insured, falls under the regulations of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, falls under the regulations of DMV, falls under the regulations of the Federal Trade Commission for as-is stickers. You have to have an as-is sticker in the car window that notifies the person that they're buying the car as-is. They have a right to take it to have it inspected. The dealer now under the UTPA not only has to be under this new section we talked about before about being a licensed dealer, but they have to notify people of known material defects. And who would be better qualified than a tow dealer who just brought this car in from a wreck to know, to be able to tell the consumer, by the way, this car was in a front-end wreck, and oh yeah, we replaced the front of it. So maybe they're fixing them up. I don't know if they're fixing them up or not. But they are under an obligation under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act to notify consumers of known material defects or that they knew of or should have known of. And so all of the consumer protection items, all of the DMV requirements, all of the same rules and regulations that would apply to a licensed dealer under their scenario, once they buy the car, does not apply. And I don't think that any of the lien laws, both state and federal, would grant a license to have a carte blanche ability to sell vehicles after they own the car. Once they exercise their lien rights, that lien right is done. They are no longer selling the car at liens. They're selling the car at a price. Now, I would be very curious to find out if they're not doing that first. I don't know, but I think it would be an interesting investigation to take a look at whether the lien laws are being sold properly from a consumer protection point of view, because if they're not, then perhaps these deficiency judgments shouldn't be as good as they are, because they're not properly being sold at the public auction. So there's other issues involved, but the main one is that once they acquire these cars by sale at lien, the lien sale's over. They're selling cars just like anybody else.
Questions? Representative Gallegos. My question had to do with the photos that were passed around. So you're saying that, I'm assuming you've seen these ones that Monty passed around.
I don't know if they're the ones, Representative Gallegos, Madam Chairman, I don't know if they're the ones he took me to the other day, but I can tell you if you just drive down the block here, there's 3 or 4 dealerships that are selling cars.
Well, my question has to be where it says towed car sales, where they're actually, you know, large signs where they're advertising car sales. So that is, they should not, you're saying that they shouldn't be able to legally advertise car sales, because the only time they should be selling cars is after the lien has been processed.
The only time they should be selling cars is by authorized lien auction sales. That's what the statute, the legislature many, many years ago in their wisdom decided that these people had a right to recoup their losses. And the way they chose to let them recoup their losses was in the lien foreclosure sale. No other sale. Once they're done with their lien foreclosure sale, they are now, and if they have exercised their judgment to now own that vehicle, they cannot put a sign out in front of their car and say, cars for sale. Unless, of course, they've done all the things that dealers are supposed to do and file all the paperwork that dealers are supposed to file, because now they're owners of cars. They could have just as easily sold those cars to licensed auctions, licensed auto dealers.
Follow-up?
They chose not to. They chose to sell them. Why? Well, because they can make a better profit.
Well, and can, is there a limitation on what they can sell them for under a lien sale? Is it only for the amount of the lien?
They can sell it at auction to the highest bidder. My reading of this, the lien statute is it is a non-reserve auction. No reserves. So if somebody comes in there and bids a dollar, and nobody bids more than a dollar, they win the car for a dollar. Now, the person who has the lien is not going to allow that to happen because they have a $1,000 lien on the car. So all they got to do is they'll stay at the auction and bid the auction up.
Okay.
They can bid up to the amount of their judgment.
Follow up. And the amount of, if they were able to, there was a lien for $800 and they sold it for $1,000, what happens to that?
The extra $200?
Yeah, it goes back.
It would go back to the rightful owner or the dealer in a case if there was a security interest.
Okay.
Some of these dealers finance their own contracts, and you get somebody who's a shady character comes in and buys the car, decides later, well, something's broken on the car, it's not worth fixing, they have to leave for whatever reason, the cops are chasing them, they abandon the car. And then all this burden falls back on the used car dealer, who also can get chased with a deficiency.
Representative Merkley, and then we will be closing the hearing for today.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It sounds from the description of this law like there isn't currently a provision for these types of sales, lot sales by tow companies. Why has there been, if that's the case, shouldn't there have been some enforcement by our own Department of Motor Vehicles previously to shut down these sales?
Representative Merkley, Madam Chair, I think that's probably a better question left to the Department of Motor Vehicles.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Eversall and Monty and Mr. Elkins. We appreciate this testimony. It's been fascinating, and we will continue it on Wednesday. We are adjourned.
Oh, my God. Is that so?
And she had good
He said it was just kind of hit by just a pretty short movement, but it involves them because of the leadership.
Yeah, and then he said that Monty said he would take us.